U.S. media reports say Washington is sending a large number of its new stealth combat jets to the Pacific amid rising tensions with China. Rescue workers are fighting against time to save hundreds of people trapped by floods in Germany and Belgium as the death toll passes 150. Also coming up, the European top court's ruling that hijab can be banned at work has raised concerns in the Muslim community. We'll have a report from London. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. Air Force is sending dozens of F-22 fighter jets to the Pacific amid growing tensions with China. The U.S. media says the country is deploying nearly 25 Raptors for an exercise in Guam and Tinian Islands this month. That accounts for 25% of all mission F-22 aircraft in the U.S. fleet. Military officials say the U.S. has never deployed this amount of combat warplanes in a specific Air Force's area of operation. They say the deployment would send an immediate message to China, especially at a time when the two countries are at odds over a variety of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. The Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has blamed the U.S. for the current instability in Afghanistan. For more on that, we were earlier joined by our guest in the News Review program to discuss the issue.
Welcome, everyone, to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, while Russia says the U.S. has failed in its mission in Afghanistan as the Taliban are pressing on with their territorial gains there.
The Americans left, as President Biden confirmed, because they considered their mission to be accomplished. Of course, he tried to paint it in the most positive colors, but everyone understands that the mission failed.
Sergei Lavrov said the hasty withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops from the country has destabilized the region and worsened the threat of terrorists. Lavrov also warned that the instability in Afghanistan could spread into neighboring countries. He made the remarks on the sidelines of the Central South Asia Conference in Uzbekistan. Clashes have intensified between the Taliban and Afghan government forces in recent weeks. Militants have seized dozens of districts and several border crossings with Afghanistan's neighboring countries. And now joining us for the program is Mr. E. Michael Jones, editor at Culture Wars Online magazine from South Bend, Indiana, and Mr. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer from Westchester University, joining us out of Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in South Bend with you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. Your initial thoughts on Sergei Lavrov's remarks saying the U.S. basically really turned this country upside down upon its head and now is leaving.
Well, Afghanistan was always known as the graveyard of empires. Anyone who knew history knew that. Anyone who knew history would know that the American mission there was going to fail. So it was only a matter of time. The British tried it. They ended up with William of Kandahar trying to march out of Afghanistan and being slaughtered by the natives, leaving only one man left to tell the tale. The Russians had their chance. They left in an orderly fashion, and now the United States is just going to pull out and leave in a disorderly fashion. So there are no surprises here. The mission, no one ever knew what the mission was. The mission had something to do with 9/11. What it had to do with 9/11, no one is sure. They claimed that Osama bin Laden was living in caves after a while, but that wasn't true. So the only plausible explanation that I can come up with was, number one, resurrecting the heroin trade. The Taliban had stopped the heroin production of opium by 1999. As soon as the Americans got there, the trade increased to the point where it is today. The other thing I know for certain is that it was a stage for social engineering. I met a student at Notre Dame University from there who was going to go back, and she was going to teach gender studies to the Afghani people. I tried to warn her that this was a death sentence. I hope she doesn't go back under those. She probably won't go back now because there are probably no slots open for gender studies professors in Afghanistan. So this just shows, these two examples show the futility and the pointlessness of the American involvement there.
Thank you, Mr. E. Michael Jones and Mr. Lawrence Davidson. Your initial thoughts on this?
Well, I agree, basically. I think it's rather ironic that the Russians are trying to point fingers at the U.S. They invaded Afghanistan in 79 and essentially killed, between 6 and 11% of the population, as well as a whole lot of their own people dying or injured. And and then they left. So there's not that much, really that much difference here. The Russian withdrawal led to the Taliban government. And we then went in on the thoughts that the Taliban were hosting or protecting Osama bin Laden and Bush just invaded the place. I mean, he demanded Osama bin Laden be turned over, and the Taliban said, wait a minute, we have to find him first. And Bush just didn't wait for an answer, really, and just invaded the country. And then for the next 20 years, which doubled the time the Russians were in there, the same thing played out again. And we now leave an interminable, unwinnable struggle. I think from the American public's point of view now, there are two things that I note that worry the public about this withdrawal. One, they basically wanted to be out. The American people basically agree with the withdrawal. But they worry. They worry about, for one thing, the interpreters who worked with the Americans. They're worried about their fate, and they're worried about, more generally, about the fate of Afghan women. That's because gender studies is actually popular here in the United States, and we have no real understanding of Afghan culture. So that's the state of the situation for us.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Stay safe, both of you. Mr. E. Michael Jones, joining us from South Bend, editor of Culture Wars Online Magazine, and Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer out of Westchester University, joining us from Westchester.
Welcome back. The death toll from devastating floods in Western Europe has climbed to 153 amid a rescue operation to save hundreds of more people still trapped or are still missing. Germany is the worst hit country, where police say 133 people have so far died as a result of the disaster. The flooding caused by heavy rain have also killed 20, and Belgium troops and firefighters are searching through rubble for dozens of people who are believed to be missing in Germany. The deluge has also submerged homes in Luxembourg and the Netherlands. The cost of damage in Europe's worst floods in decades is estimated to be several billion of euros. Efforts are underway to restore gas, electricity, and telephone services. The European High Court of Justice has ruled in favor of European businesses who want to sack employees for wearing religious clothing in front of customers. Although the court did say that the ban was meant to be implemented fairly and neutrally, many predict that it will be used unfairly to target Muslim women, many of whom wear the hijab or the niqab. Rob Carter reports from London.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means, or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
COVID-19 cases are surging in several EU nations, mainly attributed to the highly contagious Delta variant. The development could have major health and economic implications. Jerome Hughes has more.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here, and some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontents to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive,
be vaccinated or not. So you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The UN says the Israeli regime has demolished some 474 Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of this year. According to a UN report, demolitions have displaced as many as 656 Palestinians, including 359 children. Israel often demolishes Palestinian homes, citing different pretexts, including lacking construction permits. Rights groups have time and again denounced Israel's demolition drive and the forced expulsion of Palestinians. They argue the Israeli land grab policy is aimed at expanding its settlements, which are illegal under international law. The Israeli destruction of Palestinian homes and the usurpation of Palestinian land have made thousands homeless. With the European Union threatening to impose sanctions against Lebanese politicians, Saad Hariri has decided to step down, citing fundamental disagreements with President Aoun. Experts believe the current socio-economic, financial, and political collapse could be the end of the current governing system in Lebanon.
With angry mobs block roads and clash with the army, the price of the dollar against the Lebanese lira was skyrocketing, hinting a gloomy outlook in the horizon. In an interview Thursday night, Hariri blamed President Aoun for impeding the cabinet formation process and for his resignation.
The group led by the president has decided not to cooperate with Saad Hariri, and all the obstacles that I have faced are because of that group. I did not want to just negotiate while knowing that I cannot form a cabinet, so I resigned because it seemed to me that President Aoun does not want to form a cabinet.
Presidential office slammed Hariri for his comments, declaring that Hariri was, quote, not ready to discuss amendments of any kind, and closed the door on any talks. Experts see that Hariri is now launching an internal conflict, using resistance as a scapegoat.
It was obvious that he's preparing for his election campaign, because later in his interview yesterday night, he launched his election campaign by opening fire on the resistance in Lebanon.
Observers see that talk of electoral campaigns will be the main focus in the post-Hariri resignation era.
The Americans, they haven't reached a point to let the solution take place. They are still using the financial crisis as a blackmailing means to try to blackmail the resistance in Lebanon.
The state of despair on the streets of Beirut is a reflection of the general situation.
Everyone knew there would not be a new cabinet. The country has collapsed. If the prime minister wanted to actually form a cabinet, he would go for real negotiations. The result will be death of the people, no electricity, no water, and no fuel. Lebanon has fallen.
All the people need to protest. The rich and the poor are equal now, and all six are facing the same crisis.
They all want a piece of cheese for themselves. If they cannot rule right, they should leave. People are helpless. Hunger knows no religion or sect.
With the socioeconomic crisis quickly escalating, many believe the end result will be a probable demise of the entire political system.
French sources described Hariri's move as cynical self-destruction for the political class. Others considered it the start of an electoral campaign. But one thing all sides agree on is that it puts Lebanon in the face of a chaotic period ahead. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The death toll from catastrophic floods in western Germany and Belgium has risen to more than 125, local authorities have said. as emergency services continued their search for hundreds of people still missing. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent John Henley. The piece is titled, Death Toll Exceeds 125 as Germany and Belgium Hit by Devastating Floods. The death toll from catastrophic floods in western Germany and Belgium has risen to more than 125, local authorities have confirmed, as emergency services continued their search for hundreds of people still missing. The German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, said he was stunned by the devastation caused by the flooding and pledged support to the families of those killed and to cities and towns facing significant damage. In the hour of need, our country stands together, Frank-Walter Steinmeier said on Friday afternoon, 16th of July. It's important that we show solidarity for those from whom the flood has taken everything. Authorities in the German state of Rhineland-Palatinate said 63 people had died there, including at least 12 residents of an assisted living facility for people with disabilities, while neighboring North Rhine-Westphalia province put the death toll at 43. Officials warned the figures could rise further, about 1,300 people in the Ahrweiler district of Rhineland-Palatinate remain unaccounted for, although efforts to contact them were being hindered by damage to telephone networks. Experts said the European Flood Awareness System, the EFAS, issued an extreme flood warning earlier this week and questioned why the toll was so high. Anna Cloak, a hydrologist, told the website Politico the disaster was a monumental failure of the system. The German Weather Service, the DWD, said it had passed on the warning to local authorities who should have been responsible for organizing any necessary evacuations. The German Interior Minister, Horst Seehofer, said Germany must prepare much better in the future, adding that this is a consequence of climate change. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier called for greater effort to combat global warming. Only if we decisively take up the fight against climate change will we be able to limit the extreme weather conditions we're now experiencing, he said. Experts are saying such disasters were likely to happen more often due to climate change. Some parts of Western Europe received up to 2 months of rainfall in the space of just 2 days. World Meteorological Organization spokesperson Claire Nullis said. While she said it was too soon to blame the floods and preceding heat wave on global heating, Claire Nullis said that the climate crisis was increasing the frequency of extreme events, while many single events have been shown to be made worse by global warming. The Belgian Interior Minister, Annelies Verlinden, said the country's death toll had risen to 20, with another 20 still listed as missing. Most of the dead were found around Liège, a city of 200,000 people, despite an order for residents of central districts and areas bordering the Meuse River to evacuate. Interior Minister Annelies Verlinden said water levels on the Meuse River running into the Netherlands remained critical. There are a number of dikes on the Meuse where it really is touch and go whether they will collapse, she said. The army has been sent to 4 of the country's 10 provinces to help with rescue operations and evacuations, along with teams of emergency workers dispatched from Italy and France. Residents of some towns, including the resort of Spa, which has been underwater since late on Wednesday, were being accommodated in tents. While they have so far suffered no loss of life, Switzerland, Luxembourg and the Netherlands were also severely affected by the floods, with flash floods sweeping through the Swiss villages of Schleitheim and Beggingen. Several towns in the Grand Duchy evacuated on Thursday, and thousands were told to leave their homes in the southern Dutch city of Maastricht. The water level in the Maas River, as the Meuse is known in Dutch, reached its maximum forecast height in Maastricht on Thursday night, 15th of July, but stayed below what the authorities had termed as the doom scenario, averting widespread flooding. At least 550 households were evacuated in Roermond, while authorities in Venlo evacuated about 200 hospital patients due to the looming threat of flooding from the river. The Dutch caretaker Prime Minister Mark Rutte formally declared a disaster, freeing up state funds to pay for the damage. By far the highest death toll, though, was in Germany, where 114,000 households were without power, and rescuers on Friday were focusing their efforts on helping people trapped in their homes, particularly in the town of Erfstadt, southwest of Cologne. Regional authorities said several people had died or been reported missing after their houses collapsed when the ground beneath them sank suddenly in a major landslide. Aerial photographs show what appeared to be a massive sinkhole. "We managed to get 50 people out of their houses last night," Frank Rock, a local official, said. "We know of 15 people who still need to be rescued. One has to assume that under the circumstances, some people didn't manage to escape." Roads around Erfstadt, southwest of Cologne, were impassable, with rescue crews trying to reach residents by boat and having to rely on walkie-talkies to communicate. "The mobile network has collapsed, the infrastructure has collapsed, hospitals can't take in anyone in, nursing homes had to be evacuated," a regional government spokesperson in Cologne confirmed. Meanwhile, more rain has been forecast for parts of the region where water levels in the Rhine River and its tributaries continue to rise. Nearly 1,000 soldiers have been deployed to help with rescue operations and rubble clearing in affected towns and villages. At least 24 people were confirmed dead in Uskirchen, one of the worst-hit towns in Germany. Reporters on the scene described a normally well-ordered center transformed into a mountain of rubble and house fronts ripped off by the floods. Thousands of people remain homeless after their houses were destroyed or deemed at risk by the authorities, including several villages around the Steinbach reservoir that experts say could collapse under the weight of the floods. "I fear that we only see the full extent of the disaster in the coming days," the German Chancellor Angela Merkel said late on Thursday, 15th of July. She was speaking in Washington, D.C., where she is visiting President Joe Biden, calling it a day characterized by fear, despair, and suffering. Angela Merkel said her government would not leave those affected alone with their suffering, adding that it was doing its utmost to help them in their hour of distress. The conservative governor of North Rhine-Westphalia, Armin Laschet, who is running to succeed Angela Merkel as chancellor in elections due in September, called an emergency meeting of the cabinet on Friday, 16th of July. "It is a reality that extreme weather events will influence our everyday life more strongly in the future," Armin Laschet said. He added, "We have to continue down Germany's path towards climate neutrality at a faster pace." But he also said that the problems caused by the climate crisis cannot be solved in North Rhine-Westphalia state or in Germany. Malu Dreyer, the governor of Rhineland-Palatinate, said climate change was not abstract anymore. "We are experiencing it up close and painfully."
the spotlight.
Now, for the first time in decades, South Africa is calling up thousands of reservists to tackle a wave of looting and violence. Food, fuel, and medicine chains have been targeted. More than 110 people have been killed and thousands more arrested. Now, all this since former President Jacob Zuma started a 15-month jail term last week. Now, what has turned rallies into violent encounters and lootings in a matter of a week? And that's what we'll put on the spotlight.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after he defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight with me, Behrouz Najafi. Now, let's see who's joining us in this edition. Full professor of political science and deputy dean of research with the University of Western Cape. Author of The Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from the 1920s to 1970s, Becky Ngomezulo in Cape Town. Okay, we'll also have the endowed chair of the History and African American Studies, author of The White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston. Now, Becky, a call-up on this scale has never happened since the end of the apartheid regime in 1994. What's been behind such an unprecedented mayhem and violence in South Africa?
Thank you very much, and good evening to our listeners. Basically, it's a combination of factors. Some of the issues have been there since 1994. When we got our freedom or our democracy in 1994, there were certain things that were not done, and there are a number of promises that were made, but which were never fulfilled. And these things have been piling up. All they needed was just a spark to ignite and then bring the country to where it is right now. So the reason why we have so many soldiers being dispatched to try and contain the situation is because of a number of mistakes that have happened, starting with the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, and then, of course, starting with the Zondo Commission on the allegations of state capture. So there have been a number of mistakes from all ends. And then when those mistakes were not corrected on time, the situation deteriorated and got out of hand. And government was unable to contain the situation using the police, as is usually the case. Hence then the reason to bring in the army to try and assist the police force. This is basically unprecedented in the post-apartheid era, and it's a shame to the country. To the continent.
Okay, Gerald, businesses in South Africa are mainly owned by whites, as you know, and they make up about 9% of the working population there. Now, most of the country's arable land remains are also owned by white farmers. The apartheid is gone, but South Africa still has one of the highest inequality rates. What's your take on that?
Well, I think if you look at what happened in neighboring Zimbabwe when there was an attempt to redress economic inequality that's grounded in racism, you saw that seizing the land of the so-called white minority caused sanctions to be imposed upon the Zimbabwean regime, and to an extent, those sanctions are still there. That was the signal to the incoming African National Congress government in 1994 that it should tread carefully. Therefore, the finger of accusations should be pointed at the sanctions imposing government, speaking of London and Washington in the first place. And that brings me to the other issue. When the African National Congress government came to power in 1994, one of its major allies, speaking of the Soviet Union, had just collapsed. That helped to empower the major ally of the white minority, speaking of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And that also handicapped the ability of the incoming ANC government to address these questions of equality and inequality. And I would add another factor, and that is the maladministration of Jacob Zuma now sitting in prison. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake when the African National Congress government recalled his predecessor, speaking of Thabo Mbeki, who was the successor as president of Nelson Mandela. They recalled Mbeki put Zuma in that position. There were many reasons for that, but in any case, in retrospect, that was a major blunder, because now Zuma and his comrades and cronies charged with looting the treasury of billions and billions of dollars that could have been used to redress inequality, could have been used to confront this COVID crisis that is now harming South Africa more than any other country on the African continent. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Mr. Zuma personally bears a good deal of responsibility for this crisis, as does the members of the African National Congress who helped to put him in office in the first place.
Okay. Now, Becky, as you know, the unemployment rate is pretty high in South Africa, especially among the youth. It's reached a record level of nearly 33% in the first quarter of 2021. So tell us how seriously this unemployment thing could affect the tide of dissatisfaction and all these objections.
Yes, indeed, it is a critical factor. And in fact, what started off as a group of people who were supporting the former President Zuma, as I said earlier on, it triggered the problems that were already underlying there, and we're just waiting for a trigger to spike all of these things that have happened. If you look at the population of South Africa and the population of the African continent, for that matter, it is predominantly young. So then if you have a number of graduates who leave universities and colleges and then join the public with the hope of bettering their lives, and only to find themselves adding numbers to the unemployment rate, then, of course, it's a cause for concern.
Okay, looks like we've had some technical problem. Let's turn to Houston. Gerald, protests into the jailing of Zuma turned into looting and vandalism, as you know. Is this the disgruntled people? Who is leading this?
Well, that is a major question. The government has suggested that there are disgruntled elements within the ranks of the African National Congress, within the ranks of the security forces, who have played a very negative role with regard to the plundering and looting that has taken place in South Africa in recent days. That bespeaks, I'm afraid to say, the factionalism within the highest ranks of the African National Congress. But there is another issue, too, that should be addressed. Given that we are putting so much weight on the alleged misdeeds of the African National Congress, that raises the question of where's the opposition? And that, too, is a problem, because if you look at the major opposition party, which is the Democratic Alliance, so-called, it's basically a neo-apartheid policy. It basically seeks to defend the interests of the so-called white minority, and therefore does not have much purchase or much of a reputation amongst the African majority. Then you have a group like the so-called economic fighters, which tries to posture itself to the left of the African National Congress. But recall that when Mr. Zuma came into power more than a decade ago, one of the major backers of Mr. Zuma was Julius Malema, who then went on to lead the economic freedom fighters. In fact, he was quoted at the time as saying he would give his life on behalf of Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the political opposition has not carried the kind of responsibility that it should have, and that only contributes to the crisis.
Okay, Becky in Cape Town seems to be back. Becky, you hear me, right?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, Becky, you know, this military deployment is huge and it's extremely costly and could impose further burden on South African faltering economy. And vigilante groups have been formed to protect infrastructure in their neighborhoods. So what's the right way to restore calm?
You know, there are a couple of issues. For me, one of the options is for the justice system to correct itself. Because if you look at the manner in which the case of former President Zuma was handled, as I said earlier on, it was not handled properly. The judiciary was supposed to have looked at what the law says, but then at the same time consider the possible options in law and then look at the political situation in the country. One of the options they would have taken, for example, would be to say former President Zuma has been found to be in contempt of court, and then he's in the wrong, and therefore we find him guilty. But then in terms of sanctioning, they should have just said they are giving him a suspended sentence, not because he has not done anything wrong, but because they are trying to remedy the situation. The second option was, in fact, in my view, okay, a mistake. And on Monday, by the way, there were presentations by former President Zuma's team trying to plead with the Constitutional Court to reverse its decision, and the judgment has been withheld until further notice. So right now, there is no political solution to this issue, because legally, the president cannot give him pardon unless he has served at least a quarter of his sentence. So the onus now is on the judiciary to rescue the situation without contravening the Constitution, and also without breaking the law, because in any case, they will be found to have been in contempt of the law themselves. So for me, that is where I see things going right now.
Okay, now let me turn to Houston and ask Gerald what he thinks is the right way to handle this. Because, you know, Gerald, this has been really unprecedented since a long time ago, like we spoke about. You know, there's vandalism, there is looting and killing. So is this army deployment the right thing to do? Could that restore tranquility or what?
I'm not sure if putting more soldiers on the streets will restore tranquility. Recall that just a few days ago, the president, Mr. Ramaphosa, suggested that there would only be 2,500 soldiers. Mm-hmm. Now there are about 10 times that many, and the unrest continues in KwaZulu-Natal. I think that part of the problem in South Africa, and it's a question that has occurred to me and many friends here in the United States, is that it's rather curious that Mr. Zuma, a post-1994 president, has been jailed. And yet these pre-1994 leaders, of which there are many in South Africa, that is to say those who devised apartheid, those who presided over terror and murder, none of them have been jailed. So I would hope that coming out of this crisis is a decision to go after some of the folks who helped to create this crisis in the first place. Mm-hmm. Speaking of these allies of the United States of America, speaking of these enforcers of apartheid, because we all recognize that one of the reasons why there's so much poverty and inequality in South Africa in the first instance that has driven people into the streets is that it's direct legacy of apartheid. If that is the case, and it certainly is the case, will those who helped to devise apartheid and enforce apartheid have blood on their hands, and they should be punished accordingly?
Okay. Now, Becky, there are some analysts who attribute the situation to factional rivalries inside the ruling African National Congress Party, and that was what Gerald also referred to. Is that the case in your opinion?
No, it is absolutely one of the contributing factors, but not the only factor. Because right now, if you look at the governing party, You look at the NWC, the National Working Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the National Executive Committee, it is divided to the core. You look at the PEC, the Provincial Executive Committees, in all the 9 provinces, they are divided to the core. And mm-hmm. then it goes down to the local branches. So if you have that kind of a situation, it means that whatever action you take will be interpreted along those lines. And in fact, I may add that when the president addressed the nation both on Sunday and on Monday, he didn't help the situation because he gave the impression that this can be reduced to nothing but ethnic mobilization. That is the concept he used, ethnic mobilization. And I'm one of the people who have subsequently written pieces challenging him on that, saying that if you reduce this important issue to ethnic mobilization, the next thing that will happen, you will have racial problems like we are seeing already right now. So I think there are a couple of problems that need to be attended to, but factionalism in the ANC in fact creates fertile ground for all these other problems to pop up.
Okay. Now, Gerald, there are also some people that are saying that there is evidence that followers of former President Zuma have provoked some of the recent unrest to undermine rivals to return him to power. Is that a possibility?
Well, certainly if you look at the social media feeds of some of Mr. Zuma's family members, not to mention some of his comrades and friends, it would obviously lead you to that conclusion. But I think we need to take a step back and look at the region as a whole. That is to say, it was only a few days ago that neighboring Swaziland, Eswatini as it's now called, was going up in flames. People were being killed by the security forces because of protests against the last absolute monarchy on the African continent. Zimbabwe, the neighbor to the north, as mentioned, is still reeling from sanctions imposed by the United States, Great Britain, and its allies because of its land reform program. And that has led to a steady drift, a steady migration of people from Zimbabwe into South Africa, which then puts pressure on the social welfare system in South Africa, puts pressure on the system of employment in South Africa as well, contributing to these problems. And then to the east and to the north, you see problems in Mozambique, which is suffering from an insurgency spearheaded by religious zealots who supposedly have ties to the so-called Islamic State. And in fact, there has been talk about South Africa and its neighbors contributing troops to Mozambique, and that too has led to a migration of Mozambicans into South Africa. So you cannot look at South Africa in a vacuum. You have to look at it in the regional context. And when you do, you see that there are many regional problems that are impinging upon the rule of the African National Congress in Pretoria.
Okay. Now, Becky, business confidence has plunged further, especially with this recent looting taking place in South Africa. On top of that, there is unemployment that you mentioned, especially among the youth, complicating the situation. So what's the solution?
At the moment, there is no immediate solution. The first thing that we can do, I was saying to you, some people in the media houses earlier today, that the first step for me is to eliminate one problem, which sparked this whole thing. That is the issue of the former president. Try to address it within the parameters of the law. Like I was saying, that the judges have withheld the judgment on the appeal that has been made. So that is for me the first step. Because once you eliminate that one, then it means that those who have joined the bandwagon, either as opportunists or as criminals, we will then be in a position to face them because we will have eliminated the main causal factor. So that is the first step. Then, of course, the other one will be for the government to try as much as possible to make sense of the situation and then bring together the international community, more especially international businesses and local businesses, and explain to them, give them confidence as to how they are handling the situation. Because the longer this turmoil takes, the more difficult it will be for the country to recover economically, given the fact that even before the pandemic, the country's economy was already not doing well. With or without the former president, the economy was just going down.
Now, Gerald, what's your prediction? What's going to happen next in the coming days? Will we see calm or will we see an escalation? We have 1 minute.
It's difficult to make a prediction, but I have to say I'm quite worried about the trend that's taking place in South Africa. You might have seen the statement put out by former President Thabo Mbeki, where he basically made the allegation that the entire post-1994 democratic process may be in jeopardy because of what's going on. Certainly the ongoing unrest in KwaZulu-Natal does not inspire confidence. However, I think that it's important for the South African authorities to redouble their efforts to redistribute the wealth, and particularly to redistribute the wealth on racial grounds, because that's the only way to address the toxic and poisonous legacy of apartheid.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guest. We had full professor of political science and deputy dean of research for the University of Western Cape, author of Politics and Higher Education in East Africa from 1920s to 1970s, Becky M. Gomezulo in Cape Town, an endowed chair of history in African American studies, author of White Supremacy Confronted, Gerald Horn in Houston with their contribution. I've been your host, Pat Ruznajatin. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Islamic Upbringing here at IRIB English Radio. Most of the things that we are going to mention and discuss here are based on the book Children in Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. You can find the book online, I suppose, and please stay in touch and keep on track. And if you've got questions from the book or from your own lives, we would be more than happy to address them. I welcome Brother Miqdad to another show. Salaamu Alaikum, brother.
Wa Alaikum Salaam Wa Rahmatullah.
We're talking about self-confidence based on a question that you had sent us. We left off at self-confidence and giving respect to their child and responsibilities, giving them responsibilities and acknowledging what they've done, even if it's fulfilling a responsibility or performing a task. Do we have more to talk about?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we were talking about how to instill confidence, having talked about what really confidence is and the signs of true confidence. We're then looking at instilling confidence in a child, and we saw how important it is to show respect, give importance, give value, allow children to take decisions. The last one that you, as you mentioned, we talked about giving children responsibilities and then valuing the results of those responsibilities that they perform successfully. And when we really value that which they perform, and children see that they are actually doing something valuable, fruitful, efficient, something that has an impact in somebody else's life, an impact on their parents, for example, they actually really believe that they have value, and their goals and their ambition to do things increases. Another thing that's very important is to consult children, to ask children for their opinion. And parents, and this doesn't need to be faked, actually, sometimes you would find that children have a lot of interesting things to say and interesting perspective to things.
Yeah, which you least expect.
So many times when you have decisions to take as a family or decisions to take related to work, just as you would talk to somebody and ask them their opinion and what do you think I should do for this, consulting with somebody, it's actually quite valuable to do the same with children. And when children see that I have been taken seriously in certain matters and my opinion has value, then this again plays a role in them feeling valuable.
What age are these children are you talking about?
From the age of 7, 8, 9 onwards, you see children can have a lot of good analysis in certain places, and it's actually the start of a good, healthy conversation as well. Many a times when we have conversation, we forget that children are can be part of a conversation, and very often children are listening to their parents, and they feel shy to take part of a conversation. Whilst it's important that when you're on the dinner table, for example, children should also have a say in the conversation that you're having, whether it's related to the news, it's related to sports, it's related to what happened at work, for example, it's related to what we're going to do when we go on a holiday, for example. Children take part of discussions around the table, they take part in the conversation that happens, and they feel that they have a place in the family. They feel that they, I'm also an important, valuable member of the society. And this plays a role, again, in strengthening their confidence, believing that they are important, they are able to do things, they're able to be efficient and effective in society and in themselves.
Right, so we're going to go off for a break, if that's okay with you, Brother Misbah. We're going to return, continuing about how to install self-confidence in your child. Please stay tuned, realists.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing.